For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I'm very happy to have with us this evening as our guest speaker, Professor Chris Ives, who is one of the leading American scholars on Buddhist social ethics, and particularly Zen history and social ethics. He teaches at Stonehill College, is that right, near Boston, and amongst his books, his latest is Imperial Way Zen. And Chris is here at the American Academy of Religion conference. So we had Stephen Hine yesterday morning, and now we have Chris this evening joining us to talk about Buddhism and social ethics. So thank you very much, Chris, for being here.
Well, thank you, Ty, again, and thanks to all of you for coming tonight. I know it's a busy week with Thanksgiving coming and all. What I thought I'd do is maybe just offer about 25, 30 minutes of comments, and I sense that'll give us maybe 15 minutes to bat around some ideas. And as you'll see, some of what I'm talking about is based on material I've looked at in depth, and toward the end of my comments, it'll be more thinking about some things and wanting to hear from all of you. So, yeah, let me just dive in. I have some prepared comments, and then we can open it up in a little while. About 30 years ago, while I was in graduate school in Los Angeles after coming back from 5 years in Kyoto, I started realizing that Zen was not as politically detached, reclusive, and iconoclastic as people like Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki had made it out to be, or that it was wise and compassionate in the exact ways my teachers in Kyoto had made it out to be. As you may know, like other sects of Japanese Buddhism, Zen, especially Rinzai Zen, historically has been intimately connected to the ruling elite in Japan, whether emperors, shoguns, aristocrats, 19th century oligarchs, or 20th century militarists. From the time of the introduction of Buddhism to Japan in the 6th century, there's been cooperation between Buddhism and the state, a kind of symbiosis, to use that term from biology, with Buddhist institutions providing rituals for the health and safety of the ruler, helping legitimate various governments and their laws, and in certain cases serving as de facto government officials in the Japanese countryside, doing things like censuses, education, other types of things for the state. As one scholar in our field put it, rituals were the coinage by which monks purchased patronage. As this quote indicates, rulers reciprocated with patronage by providing land, temples, protection, sometimes protection from other denominations of Buddhism, and other forms of concrete support. What we have here is an ongoing marriage between Buddhism and the state. And this is encapsulated in a variety of expressions. There's one in Japanese, obo bupo soi, which means the mutual dependence between the obo, the emperor's law, and the bupo, the Buddha's law or the Dharma, seeing the law, the land, and the Dharma being complementary to each other. Now, when prominent Buddhists did talk about society or articulated systems of what we might call social ethics, more often than not, they drew heavily from Confucianism, exhorting their flocks to be loyal, filial, and dutiful. In this way, they articulated social stances supportive of what usually were hierarchical and authoritarian political structures. And this continued down to the 20th century. For example, and Tygon was just referring to one of my books, where I look at a core value of modern imperial ideology, the ideology around the emperor during World War II, where the emperor is represented as a benevolent leader, sort of the national father, bestowing blessings on his subjects. And the subjects, in turn, in this whole sort of ideological system, are expected to be indebted, grateful, loyal, and self-sacrificial. And Buddhists were there accommodating this and actually tying Buddhist doctrines into this whole ideology around the emperor and his subjects. For example, the Buddhist doctrine of the four debts to the ruler, parents, the three treasures, and other sentient beings lent itself to this kind of accommodation of the imperial ideology. The doctrine of no soul. Here you have the doctrine reinterpreted, not in the sense that we might think of it as a kind of negation of the ego or letting go of the thinking, worrying mind, in the sense of awakening to some larger identity through that self-emptying, but rather non-ego or non-soul, this doctrine reinterpreted in the sense of dying as an individual and awakening to an identity with the Japanese nation state. There's an expression, meshi hoko, which literally means obliterating the self and serving the public. In other words, this form of Japanese engaged Buddhism, you know, what I'd say here is that I know engaged Buddhism is used in a technical sense, being coined in the 20th century by Thich Nhat Hanh, but technically what you see throughout most of Japanese history from the time of the introduction of Buddhism is a form of Buddhism being engaged in social and political affairs, a kind of engaged Buddhism. And what you see here is a different interpretation of Buddhist doctrines than people like Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama or some of us in this room might lend to these doctrines as we think about our contemporary situation. You'll see this, for example, in the doctrine of dependent co-arising, however you translate pratityasamutpada, interrelational arising, Thich Nhat Hanh's notion of interbeing, and the Buddhist doctrine of emptiness, in Sanskrit, shunyata. And if you think about this roughly as, you know, engaging the whole relationship between the one and the many, the sense of I affect all things affect and constitute me. And you think about when this gets an ethical read, maybe by a lot of this, a lot of us in the room, for lack of a better expression, let's just say sort of Western engaged Buddhist, often we interpret the whole idea of interrelational arising or interbeing in some cases when we give it an ethical read rather than sort of a metaphysical read as a letting go of myself, my fixated self, really realizing an identity with that which previously was other. The notion of getting a deeper realization into how my actions affect the world around me. And ethically we see that as maybe leading to a greater sense of awareness and responsibility for the ripple effects of all of our actions. It's interesting when you see the Japanese, especially during the wartime period in the 1930s, interpreting the very same doctrine in ethical terms. Often it's much more the many to the one. Not so much I've got to be aware of the impact of my actions, take responsibility, be more mindful, but rather how indebted I am to the various things I receive, the things constituting me, whether it's my mother and my father, the ruler, the Japanese state in general. And this really leads to an ethic not so much of I need to be more mindful and aware of my actions and take responsibility as a kind of individual, but rather that sense of my indebtedness to all the people that have given me these blessings, and then the consequent gratitude and the sense of obligation. Again, much more the many to the one rather than the one to the many. This doesn't mean that the Japanese don't look at the other side. I mean, there's obviously a taking into account of one's own actions and their impact. And you'll see this especially in Japanese Buddhist historical interpretations of the doctrine of karma. Here, mostly looking at the notion of how past actions have determined my present lot in life. And it often gets a deterministic read in Japanese Buddhism in terms of karma justifying the social order. We all are reaping the fruits of past action, and the contemporary social order, the political status quo, my lot in life, is a function of my own karma. So you get these different reads by different forms of engaged Buddhism, depending on the context, whether it's Japan in the 1930s or North America at present. Now, separate from the issue of how historical Japanese Buddhists have engaged in a kind of social and political engagement, how that's differed from contemporary engaged Buddhism in the West, there's a related topic that's worth considering. And this is the question of how hanging over a lot of the constructs that we might deploy ourselves as we think through how I, as a practicing Buddhist, might engage the world through the Buddhist Peace Fellowship on my own or whatever, the doctrines that we might deploy in our own sort of thinking through of the issues, maybe our interrelational arising or the doctrine of no soul, notions of non-dualism, compassion, the five precepts. And what we see here with a lot of these doctrines, just like the one or two I just mentioned, is how they do lend themselves to multiple interpretations and, by extension, multiple and varied ethical stances. You might say that in a certain sense, they're ethically malleable. And historically, when you look at Japan, and we can think about whether this pertains to what's going on, say, in North America, it's often been non-Buddhist values, concepts, and doctrines that have colored the particular interpretation of these Buddhist doctrines. And this malleability, for example, is evident in some things I was just touching upon. Again, how we compare how wartime Japanese Buddhists and contemporary engaged Buddhists, maybe some of us, have interpreted these doctrines like no soul, interrelational arising, indebtedness, etc. Often in Japan, these doctrines, especially during the war, have been interpreted to advance an ethic of what you might call obligatory self-sacrifice, and especially during the wartime period, self-sacrifice for an increasingly hierarchical and totalitarian state. While the latter, at our hand, in terms of our interpretations, in many cases, for a lot of us, when we've worked with these concepts like interrelational arising, etc., we've tended to articulate ethics that are much more concerned about egalitarian interrelationship, perhaps in democratic communities, inclusive of other species. The very same doctrine, but getting a very different interpretation here. In other words, while tapping the same doctrines, the ethical reflection of wartime Japanese Buddhists was highly influenced by the traditional Japanese Confucian ethos and by the political milieu of the early 1930s, just as perhaps views of our engaged Buddhism, views of contemporary engaged Buddhists, may be saturated with notions of representative democracy, legal and political equality, human rights, animal rights, and the value of environmental sustainability. And so what this leaves us with is, if certain Buddhist concepts are, in a sense, malleable, we can splice onto them Confucianism or Western liberal thought, that generates the question of whether any core components of Buddhism point inexorably to specific moral stances and preclude other divergent and perhaps contesting stances. If not, something else is needed to sort out these various interpretations of these doctrines to make judgments about which stances, wartime Japanese Buddhist stances or the stances, say, of Thich Nhat Hanh, are most in accord with the Dharma. Now, speaking of core components of Buddhism here that might be our touchstone for adjudicating these different stances, I'm not assuming that there's a singular, true, or pure Buddhism. And even if there were such a thing, I would not want to argue that one should never develop Buddhist ethics through extra-Buddhist ideas. Indeed, historically, bringing outside constructs and values to bear on the tradition is nothing novel, for this has occurred throughout Buddhist history. In East Asia, Zen Buddhists, as I mentioned a minute ago, have assimilated many Confucian values. In Japan, you can also see the elements of Shintoism, the Japanese indigenous tradition. And throughout most of Japanese history, very few Buddhists have taken any issue with this. The tradition is seen as something, maybe it's skillful means, who knows, that can accommodate local worldviews, local ethical and conventional ethical systems. And in that same vein, many engaged Buddhists, perhaps born into traditions such as Christianity and Judaism, have been shaped by an array of non-Buddhist values, moral stances, and political philosophies, which many of us have brought to our practice of and reflections on Buddhism. But I think it is worth considering, as a maybe parenthetical comment, whether in our attempts to address specific moral issues, contemporary Buddhist ethicists are formulating genuinely Buddhist ethical stances, or are, consciously or otherwise, engaging in acts of looking selectively in Buddhist sources, such as religious experiences, texts, doctrines, practices, and institutions, to find support for the ethical and political stances that we brought to our practice of Buddhism in the first place. Simply put, we need to reflect on how Buddhist our stances are, how true our ethical arguments are to Buddhist sources. A further issue here, and some of you I'm sure have run into this in terms of thinking about Buddhism in North America and other places outside of Asia, is the question of whether engaged Buddhists are developing Buddhism, or as some critics claim, distorting it or watering it down. Here too, we encounter the question of what the core of Buddhism might be, of what exactly is getting distorted or watered down. So at this point, let me just offer a few tentative conclusions based on what I've just said. First, engaged Buddhism is not new. Second, forms of engaged Buddhism in Asia historically have often diverged from and conflicted in terms of their views of society relative to Western engaged Buddhism. Many of the key concepts we deploy, regardless of our form of engaged Buddhism, are ethically malleable. And many of our stances ultimately are shaped by extra-Buddhist influences. Again, certain cultural values, Confucianism, Shinto, Western liberal democracy, notions of human rights that we bring to these traditions. Now, it's interesting. In most cases, when Buddhist ethicists in Japan have made arguments or formulated certain types of social ethics, they've done so without formulating first principles of criticism. In other words, saying, this is my touchstone, this is my criterion on the basis of which I'm going to argue about this or that issue. And in some cases, and again, this is in large part due to the influence of conventional Japanese ethics on Buddhist thinkers, the pervasiveness of Confucian thought, many times you can find cases where you might want to argue that these social stances are actually in tension with key Buddhist principles, whether non-harming or compassion. Now, this has led some writers, you may have heard this, brand wartime Zen, for example, as anti-democratic, co-opted, or fascist. Now, it's easy, though often a little bit anachronistic and maybe, in some cases, intellectually imperialist, to label Zen this way, insofar as these adjectives, anti-democratic, fascist, etc., may imply criteria from outside Buddhism. Again, the question is there any Buddhist criterion or set of criteria that is somehow representative of the more universal, if not culturally transcendent, elements of the Dharma that might be deployed to adjudicate all these differences? What is authentically Zen? What happened in Japan in the 30s? What Thich Nhat Hanh is saying? What some of you might be engaged with? Or authentic Tibetan Buddhism or Vipassana, whatever your path might be. In the case of Zen, again, the tradition historically has been a thoroughly embedded Japanese religion embracing conventional mores, again, Confucian ethics, both before, during, and after the war. And Zen thinkers have never tried to systematically or rigorously formulate any kind of ethical stance based on more universal Buddhist principles. In that sense, their ethical reflection and argumentation has been, in a sense, parochial and very much colored by conventional ethics rather than any kind of transcendent Buddhist critical standpoint. And so the question for some of us, I think, is what might be those universal Buddhist criteria that we can use to sort out certain stances or to make personal decisions? Are there any norms or values that are transcendent of conventional morality? Now, that's tricky, I think, for a lot of Japanese Buddhist clerics to engage in that. For most Japanese priests, as you may know, are focused on getting trained in monasteries, performing rituals, administering temples, and insofar as they engage in any kind of study, it's mainly studying koan collections and certain sutras. And so the question for a lot of us then is, what are the core Buddhist values that we can use to employ as Buddhist rather than extra-Buddhist and transcendent rather than conventional criteria for doing these sorts of assessments. So what are those options for those of you who are involved in Zen practice? Now, some Zen ethicists lift up Zazen and Satori, or awakening, as the key to ethical life, on the assumption that people deepen their practice and are awakened, and at that point will just know what to criticize or what to do. Other people have lifted up compassion as the value around which you can build an ethic. Some people lift up the first precept of non-harming. A lot of these are tricky, though, when you really start to try to figure out, okay, can I come up with an ethical system where I can really make decisions and really sort of, again, adjudicate these different political stances I'm discussing here? For example, there are traditional Zen texts that do point to Zazen and awakening. Hakuin, the great Rinzai Zen master, in his chant in praise of Zazen, his Zazen Wasan, he writes, quote, "Observing the precepts, repentance, and giving, the countless good deeds, and the way of right living all come from Zazen. Thus, one true samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions." One Zen philosopher that I worked a lot with, a fellow by the name of Masao Abe, argued that Satori, or awakening to emptiness, generates wisdom and compassion, very much a traditional Mahayana construct, and that this wisdom and compassion generated automatically, spontaneously out of the awakening to emptiness, then generates certain vows and upaya, compassionate action, again, automatically and reflexively. But even if we allow for the sake of the argument that Abe is right, and that Satori, equipped with these two core faculties, wisdom, compassion, the two main attributes of a bodhisattva, does play a role in a Zen master's working one-on-one with a disciple to liberate that person in a religious sense, how sufficient is this notion for prophetic moral critique, both of individuals and society? Even D.T. Suzuki argued after the war that, quote, "by itself, Satori is unable to judge the right and wrong of war." Zen teacher Bernie Glassman has argued that, quote, "even while possessing great realization, we still have our conditioning, our own particular characteristics, our own particular paths. Little of that changes overnight." Close quote. So maybe looking to Zazen awakening, how much does that give us? It's an open question. This is something we can talk about, I hope, tonight. Other Zen thinkers deploy compassion. The tricky thing with compassion, as I've argued in several writings, is that even though compassion is a religiously positive value, in key respects, it's devoid of specificity. And so that opens up the whole question of, and some of you may be aware of this, different justifications of behavior saying, no, I was acting out of compassion when I hit my student, or I was acting out of compassion when I did this or that action to another person. A lot of Zen masters during World War II said that it was out of compassion that the Japanese military was liberating Asians from the oppression of Western colonialism. How do we sort those different claims about what is compassion? It's similar to the whole question of, you know, an abusive person saying, no, I did that out of love. It was in the best interest of the person I was hitting. I just did it out of love. Don't judge me. But wait, there needs to be some other element brought into the picture to say, when do we accept that as what ethical love versus abusive, quote unquote, love, even if the motivation is the person's love. Then there's non-harming, the first precept. You know, how much mileage can we get out of that? And this is the classic question that comes up when people interpret, say, the Ten Commandments or the 613 mitzvot of Judaism. How do you interpret this? As some of you know, the Mahayana tradition has allowed for violations of the first precept for the sake of compassionate, skillful means to liberate others, upaya trumping some of the precepts. There's talks about, you know, bodhisattvas manifesting as prostitutes to liberate people, in some cases as the jhans of prostitutes to liberate the prostitutes. So here, too, we're left with the sort of intellectual labor of saying, how do we exactly interpret, say, the first precept? Is it an absolute prohibition that would point Buddhism toward a kind of radical pacifism? Or is it a flexible guideline that allows for self-defense, for killing that prevents greater killing, preemption, or for other exceptions that could be spelled out in a Buddhist just war or just violence theory, maybe similar to what Catholics do with just war doctrine in the Catholic tradition. So what might we be left with as a Buddhist value or doctrine around which to formulate our ethical system and to use as a touchstone for evaluating possible options when we make decisions or critique certain actions by our government or certain social situations? I wonder, in some respects, whether the Four Noble Truths allows for that kind of basic framework to work from, obviously with lots of embellishment and lots of other work, especially when you think that, you know, if you take as your working assumption that one of the universal or transcendent norms of Buddhism across all denominations is the alleviation of suffering, then perhaps we can say if that is a universal Buddhist value, maybe the Four Noble Truths allow at least for a general framework, especially when we reinterpret the Four Noble Truths in certain social and political ways. Thinking about dukkha or suffering, not just in the narrow religious sense, but in broader senses in terms of various types of oppression in society, different forms of injustice. When we think about the causes of suffering, not just looking at it in a psychological sense, say in terms of being entrapped in dualistic modes of experience or caught up in the three poisons of ignorance, greed, and ill will, but maybe thinking about how those Buddhist constructs can be deployed to thinking about larger social suffering. Some thinkers, a friend of ours, David Loy, often talks about the institutionalization of the three poisons at the macro level. Collective greed, maybe they're seen in some ways in terms of corporate plutocracy. Institutionalized ill will or anger, seen in things like militarism. Institutionalized ignorance in terms of how information flows, the media, etc. And then in terms of the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, yeah, how can we think about not just what my own liberation might entail, but what would be an optimal society in which, at least to some extent, suffering has been alleviated, if not reduced and eliminated. And then finally, the whole question of the Eightfold Path or our praxis. What is our actual practice, not just on the cushions in terms of the traditional Four Noble Truths, but praxis at a socio-political level? And so that's fine and dandy. We say, okay, obviously we have Chris here tonight. He's an academic. He's an ethicist. He thinks about all these sort of broader frameworks and larger principles. But, you know, more immediately and more concretely, yeah, what does Buddhism offer in terms of social ethics? And I know a lot of you have thought about that, whether we're dealing with the climate crisis, whether we're dealing with corporate power, whether we're dealing with American imperialism or other forms of globalized violence. One thing I play with, and I'll just close with a couple of thoughts to toss out here and we can bat them around, the poison of ignorance. And obviously Buddhism and its various denominations interpret ignorance in different ways, whether it's the failure to truly grasp impermanence or more of a Zen notion of ignorance in terms of being fixated or entrapped in a subject-object sort of dualistic mode of experiencing reality. But when you think about ignorance, maybe this is a construct that can be tweaked. You know, when I personally think about things like climate crisis or in terms of my own politics, so bear with me, the degree to which Americans maybe are not aware of the degree to which the United States is an imperial power and has been for a long time, maybe ignorance, we can play with that. Or if we just say, look at climate crisis, okay, ignorance, well, maybe ignorance in the sense of just lack of information. People just being uninformed. Ignorance in the sense of incorrect information, whether it's people buying into certain forms of greenwashing or certain types of arguments about the current global warming is just a cyclical thing that happens every 10,000 years and trying to debunk the science. Ignorance, I love to throw the hyphen in, ignorance. Ignorance as in ignoring. To what extent are we in denial in terms of the magnitude of climate crisis coming down around us? Denial and distraction. I'm sure a lot of you have conversations as Buddhist practitioners about paying attention, being aware, trying to maintain mindfulness at a time when a lot of people are caught up in all sorts of technological gadgets, virtual reality, reality TV, all the distractions we have with, you know, umpteen cable channels, all of our gadgets, all of the information that's coming at us. Ignorance also in the sense of ideologies that justify certain scenarios. Why worry about climate crisis? The end is coming near, Jesus is coming back, and what you should do is basically get right with God rather than worrying about greenhouse gases. Maybe ignorance in the sense of disconnection. To what extent is the denial a function of people just being disconnected from their embodiment, from the biosphere, etc.? The other thing that, you know, I often think about, and my students often bring up, is, you know, what else could Buddhism bring to the table? I think in some ways, and this is true of a lot of religious traditions, is giving people a certain mindset or a certain attitude that may then lead to activism. I once did a workshop out at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies entitled Rethinking Rich. And maybe one of the things that Buddhism can offer is not necessarily a unique form of activism, like a Buddhist spin on the Occupy movement or some kind of Buddhist civil disobedience that's uniquely Buddhist in some way. Maybe one thing Buddhism can offer is, for a lot of people, a different notion of what is a fulfilling life, a life that is rich, not in a materialistic sense, but rich experientially or in terms of community in a sangha, living simply, living with others closer to the land or closer to nature, even nature in Chicago as it manifests it right here in a more urban environment. Maybe that's one thing that is one of the main resources of Buddhism, is giving people another notion of fulfillment to get them out of the consumerist rat race, to make them see that, okay, there is a simpler way of being here. A lot of religious traditions do offer this, but maybe this is something that's uniquely Buddhist. And then just the last question, yeah, if we go from, okay, Buddhist critiques of ignorance, maybe the three poisons provide a good interpretive tool, maybe Buddhism can give people a different sense of fulfillment, then we are also looking at the issue of, you know, that may not be enough. Yeah, a lot of us could live more simply, but certain powers will continue doing their thing. The fossil fuel industry is alive and doing quite well, thank you. With, you know, a lack of campaign finance reform, with, you know, undue influence on our elected representatives. And so, you know, what as Buddhists do we do? Is it more our prime value? Maybe if we do go with the Four Noble Truths, is alleviating suffering, and I'm going to try to find the movement, maybe Occupy, maybe Greenpeace, maybe the Buddhist Peace Fellowship that I see as most effective. It doesn't have to be uniquely Buddhist. Maybe I'm going to work with Quaker friends and do some, you know, Quaker-style activism. Maybe I'm going to link up with my Catholic cohort and really exercise that preferential option for the poor. But the whole question is, you know, is there necessarily a uniquely form, a Buddhist form of practice, or does there even need to be? Maybe it's basically trying to figure out, you know, what's happening out there, who are the people engaged in certain types of activism, running for political office, protest, occupying, and which of those activisms seems to alleviate suffering more than others. And I, as a Buddhist, will plug into that rather than feeling that I need to come up with a uniquely Buddhist approach, something that will be distinctive. Maybe that's a certain kind of Buddhist pragmatism. The bottom line is to alleviate injustice and suffering, and maybe the best way to do that is to link up with the Catholic Workers Movement or to join the Communist Party or join the Republican Party, depending on your interpretation. But let me just stop there. Again, at this point, I'm throwing out some ideas. I'd actually like to hear from you. I know many of you are practitioners of Buddhism. Some of you are involved in the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And maybe, you know, I don't want to lead with a question, but When you think about Buddhism and society, the magnitude of the crises we're facing, this is where I'm picking your brain selfishly, what do you think is the most important thing Buddhism can bring to the table? What is the Buddhist contribution? Or is it, again, well, I'm going to try to alleviate suffering and I'll hook up with others who may be a little further down the road in their agitation or activism? So let me stop there and we can all just sort of have at it. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Very thought-provoking, useful talk. So many people here probably could say many things. Please, questions, comments, responses for Chris. Kazan.
I don't know how to encapsulate this, but a persistent issue coming up for me throughout the talk was my discomfort with the idea of being a Buddhist. And this, it's ironic. Here I am, to all appearances a Buddhist. But I'm, and there's a long Zen tradition of Buddhist, of Zen teachers saying, oh, I'm not a Buddhist. And you can be kind of cheeky about it, but I find myself really pretty profoundly uncomfortable from a certain perspective. There are other times where it feels quite supportive and useful internally, personally, psychologically, to think of myself as a Buddhist. But then that's about 5% of the time. 95% of the time I'm kind of uncomfortable with the term. And I know some scholars have talked about how that term is a fairly recent European invention that didn't exist in Asia, that people in Asia... And maybe you can fill this out, because I'm not reading these texts originally. This is sort of, I'm getting the second hand, but call themselves followers of Buddha, or students of the way, or students of Buddha, followers of the way, something like that, which I feel much more comfortable with. Personally, in my own head, that feels more accurate. Buddhist being some kind of thing, so therefore, kind of a Buddhist ethic, and move from a position where you have an ethic, which feels quite dogmatic in a way. Like you have a dogma that you're trying to move from, which feels like more of the same problem. So this is the theme that's coming up for me, and I'm sure not a novel issue for you. Maybe you could just address that. Wow.
In some ways, maybe the most genuinely Buddhist thing to do in terms of non-attachment and that sort of vow to alleviate suffering is to... not even set up the whole discourse like I just did in terms of, okay, what's a uniquely Buddhist thing, what Buddhist criteria, what Buddhist values, maybe just, to accept a kind of, I often talk to myself as, kind of a mongrel, hybrid approach identity and not get into those labels. And that leaves us the question, in what moment, especially when you want to have, effective engagement, are those labels helpful? Or on a related issue, and I don't want to speak for any of you, but as probably many of us know, a lot of people, especially in all these categories are tricky. They're say convert Buddhists in North America as opposed to immigrant Buddhists from Asia. I mean, one reason that maybe some of us are here in this room is, in my case, the little congregational church in New England that I grew up in didn't work for me. Or my Reformed Jewish shul in New Rochelle, New York, didn't quite work for me. And that whole, turning to the Dharma, to groups, as a reaction against institutionalized religion, then the question is, okay, how do we form a Sangha? What kind of institution does this community, right here in Chicago want to be? And that whole question, I'm often, like a sort of an old hippie Buddhist, critical of institutionalized religion, and as a scholar, when I see how it can justify violence like institutional Zen did during the war. But by the same token, when you look at how, religious organizations, even with all the baggage of their hierarchy and their kind of centralized, organization, I teach at a Catholic college, so I could lift up the Catholic Church maybe as an example, how that comes with a lot of baggage and some moral issues, but how it's much more mobilizable in terms of, let's get all the churches, taking a stance around, supporting, what some people have called Obamacare. We do want to help the poor get health care, and how we can mobilize institutionalized religion to that end. Now, some of us may not agree with other ways Catholics try to, or the hierarchy tries to mobilize Catholics around other issues, but in any case, yeah, that whole question of, at what point does saying, I'm a Buddhist, help rather than hinder? At what point does institutionalized Buddhism help rather than hinder? So, no, it's not an answer, it's more, yeah, don't know.
I think that it may be problematic to try and develop an ethic from Buddhist ideas that are already in the tradition, because it does seem to a large degree that Buddhist ideas were formulated to resolve different questions from moral questions, especially social action questions. And to some extent, that may be a difference from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, where the idea of sin is not that is largely tied up with ethical action and unethical action being an offense against God, and so it's been a preoccupation from the very beginning. And so, at least I wonder, I mean, in the same way that some Catholics have, of trying to find other ways of approaching social change and then maybe critiquing them from other aspects of the tradition, so that you could work very well with Catholics or Quakers, or come up with some other framework for social action, but critique them also from within the Buddhist tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, you know, the whole problem of imperial Zen, finding a greater identity in service to the emperor and service to Japan, and the exceptionalism of the Japanese race, which they did see, chopping themselves off from other nations, seems to be in conflict with Mahayana ideas about whether there can be this pure essence of Japanese people who are different from and better than the rest of the world. You know, maybe there was a germ there within the tradition to critique that, and maybe some people used it or not. I've always been interested that, at least to some extent, some of the Nichiren schools didn't seem to get caught up in the militarism as much as Zen did and other schools, and I've always wondered why that was. Do you have any idea why they did not seem to buy in quite the same way?
Well, it's interesting when you look at Nichiren Buddhists across the spectrum. You're right, some of the folks that resisted, especially the imperial ideology, were Nichiren Buddhists, and some of the most zealous nationalists were Nichiren Buddhists. So if you look at Buddhists across the spectrum, say in the 1930s, where did they come down on, whether it's the imperial ideology or Japanese militarism? Yeah, it's interesting. Nichiren Buddhists were on both ends of the spectrum. But you're right. I mean, there were certain folks. There was one fellow named Senno Giro. And it's interesting, the Buddhists who were most outspoken, and there was a tiny, tiny minority, often were influenced by socialist thought and Marxist thought, coming out of the 1920s, and doing certain Marxist analyses of recently industrialized Japan. Often they were working there, organizing workers in factories as union organizers. And so when you do find those sites of resistance, in some cases it was coming from Buddhists influenced by Marxism. Now, in some cases, when you find, and this is interesting, I've had this discussion a lot with some close friends who are involved with Soka Gakkai. When you look at Soka Gakkai and Makiguchi Tsune Saburo, the founder, as a critical voice, what's interesting, and this is maybe answering your question, you know, what basis did that prophetic critique, you know, from what part of Nichiren Buddhism or the Lotus Sutra were they speaking? One of the main issues that Makiguchi had in the 1930s was the imperial ideology elevating the emperor above the Lotus Sutra. There are certain decrees about, you know, what you would have in your home altar. The government is asking different denominations to excise certain things from some of their texts that were seen as critical of the emperor. And to his credit, Makiguchi resisted the imperial ideology because he did not want to place the Lotus Sutra below the emperor and the whole system of venerating the emperor, and basically went to jail for that, and died in jail during the war. But he was not criticizing the militarism. And a lot of Soka Gakkai will represent him as, here's the lone or one of the few Japanese Buddhist voices who spoke out against Japanese militarism. Technically, he spoke out against the legitimating ideology behind that militarism. But still, I mean, he died for his convictions. He died for his faith. He was a critical voice going after, you know, how that ideology was affecting his religious beliefs. There's no evidence, and I've asked people who are Soka Gakkai researchers in Japan, you know, show me one place where Makiguchi spoke out against militarism, Japanese military escapades in Asia, and there's nothing. What he's speaking out against is the imperial ideology. But still, that's a rare voice, and someone could say, well, by extension, though, he's not wanting to buy into the ideology that's legitimating the militarism, that's indirectly a kind of subversive move, and you know, I guess you're right, you know, if you say that. But and you'll find one or two other Buddhists through the first half of the 20th century, not just during wartime, who do lift up notions of compassion and non-harming as a way to push back against state power. But yeah, they're often pulling from Marxist thought in their critiques, the few that did it. So. Yeah, please.
I have a couple of related questions. You know, if I understood your talk correctly, towards the end, you were sort of putting forward this kind of notion of a kind of a pragmatic view to sort of how you work with the range of concepts that you have available. Whereas earlier in your talk, you were, you know, speaking about, well, what is that, you know, what's the sort of bedrock out of which, you know, where can we go to the Four Noble Truths, can we go to this, can we go to that, as a way to, as sort of a foundation out of which to articulate a Buddhist ethic. And just thinking about myself, you know, and how I think all this stuff, I think that in practice, lean much more to the option of a kind of pragmatism, mm-hmm. whereby it seems to me, I mean, this is a very awkward thing to do, right? Because it puts the person in the position of, you know, sort of elevating yourself as, you know, being able to judge the entire tradition and say, well, those guys in Japan, man, they're wrong, you know? But, you know, which is a little embarrassing to do, but we're all in that position anyway, and, you know, so there are four, I will say, those guys in Japan, they were wrong. And part of where I do that out of is not from having a foundation, but by looking at this array of things that come to us through the tradition, and feeling like that sort of allows me both to sort of see, I mean, actually see with you know, as my understanding, that you know, a lot of what's going on in our society is wrong, and what was going on in sort of the pre-war Japan was a misinterpretation. It seems to me, from you know what you said tonight and some things that Douglas said, and from you know when I was looking at your book several months ago, you know, this sort of slippage from the sort of like basic confusion about the in Japan that. You know, I heard these guys in their books, you know, sort of articulating this view that well, merging into, you know, the state or whatever, that's the same as an atma, you know, that an atma means, you know, merging into a bigger self, which it seems like there are plenty of tools in Buddhism to see that that's kind of a twist. And so that's just kind of I don't know if that's a question, but that's an observation. A sort of more specific question I have is that, you know, you also alluded to the sort of, as it were, malleability of Buddhism, such that, you know, people in this room are bringing in Judeo-Christian concepts and, you know, beliefs about democracy, equality, all these kinds of things, and there was a different set that was brought to bear in pre-war Japan. My question has to do with how much of that, what happened, say in the 30s, was sort of a different set of concepts coming to bear, for example, from, you know, sort of fascist thinking about the state, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, and how much of it was a logical... I mean, there's obviously a connection between the sort of Confucian ethics before mm-hmm. and what happened, but they also seem quite separable. Mm-hmm. It seems like it wouldn't have to necessarily go that way. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? I mean...
Yeah.
Was there another possibility for Japanese Buddhism, or was that...
Yeah, in principle, I think so. But, you know, hearing one thing toward the end of your comment, in some sense, what happened in the 1930s was not an anomaly. And this is what I argue in the book, as you may have noticed, is that what we see there, that kind of collaboration with the state, was a modern instance, granted, in particular historical circumstances, of this traditional pattern of Buddhist-state symbiosis in a culture where there was no notion of separation of church and state, no notion, say, coming out of Hebrew Bible of great prophetic critique or speaking truth to power or witnessing. From day one, it was understood that the Dharma and the law of the land worked together, the rulers and the clerics worked together, and that, you know, phenomenon in the 1930s, this imperial way Zen, is just, yeah, a modern instance of this ongoing pattern. Now, there are certain, you know, what exact contours it took in the 1930s, yeah, that is shaped by specific historical circumstances coming out of the 19th century, etc.
But if there was a set of, you know, so you have these relationships sort of articulated in Confucianism, you know, my responsibility to family members, to different people in society, sort of finally the state. Mm-hmm. You know, like all the, I don't know much about Confucianism, but it seems like there's nothing particularizing about that. You know, I have my relation to my parents, you have your relation to your parents, I have my relation to my state, you have your relation to your state. But it seems like it takes quite a difference when it sort of becomes particularized in such a way that Douglas was sort of pointing to, where it's not only do I have this close relationship with the state, but because the, you know, the things that sort of, you know, the idea of non-self has gotten sort of coalesced into, you know, or reduced or perverted, this idea of just like obliteration of identity, you know, it kind of makes room for, it's like, well, you know, I've got my relationship with the state, and, you know, let's go get ourselves some Southeast Asia. Yeah. Let's go get ourselves some of the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I'm taking too long, but so did that have to happen? That's a stupid question.
that sort of amping up of that basic conceptual framework.
Yeah.
That it happened is not surprising. Again, I think it's, again, a line of extension or, you know, a contemporary or modern instance of that pattern. Could it have been, you know, otherwise? You know, certainly. And so the question there is, where, and maybe getting back to your question, you know, where were the sort of solitary prophets among, you know, in the Buddhist ranks that might, you know, be willing to die for their convictions and speak truth to power? And part of the tricky issue there is, if you know, unlike what you see in engaged Buddhism, we're actually involved in a panel at this conference tomorrow on Soto Zen and the precepts. Throughout most of Japanese Buddhist history, contrary to some of the things we might want to do, or teachers, you know, prominent people like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh do, Japanese Buddhists really didn't work with the Dharma to think through social issues. It basically was, oh yeah, society, yeah, we'll just sort of buy into the conventional, you know, Confucian morality. And so in terms of, you know, that muscle or that part of their brain where Japanese Buddhists might think about, this is the drift of the times, this is looking kind of totalitarian and dicey, this doesn't seem to be in sync with Buddhist values, I'm going to give someone a hard time on that. Yeah, that muscle wasn't in shape in Japanese Buddhism. There wasn't really a tradition of prophetic, and there Nietzscheanism, you know, an exception, and there's a lot of issues around the nature of his prophetic retreat, you know, back in the 13th century, but there's that sense of, yeah, socialism, we'll just defer to the conventional morality. And so things like the precepts that, you know, and we're talking about, you know, what tools might we deploy as, you know, caring Buddhists to analyze the issues around us. Well, let's, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh did with, you know, the order of interbeing, the Thiepen, you know, the 14 mindfulness trainings. Maybe we can revamp them to make them relevant and think about, okay, intoxicants, well, that can also be, you know, TV is a toxin, it's, you know, infecting my brain. We're not just talking about, you know, beer and marijuana or something. But Japanese didn't do that. I mean, there was no attempt, you know, throughout history to say, okay, you know, we got the Dharma here. Well, let's think about the five precepts in relation to feudalism or the fact that there are a lot of people starving right outside the gate. No, sort of deferring to the status quo, to authorities. When they did preach, yeah, we'll just sort of, you know, do the Confucian conventional ethic thing. And so there just was never a tradition of saying, okay, we've got these resources, let's use them as a way, you know, to stand up as bodhisattvas, to, you know, give the shogun a hard time for squeezing the peasants with excessive taxation. And so that's where, you know, it's tricky. You know, when we look back, like, you know, where was that prophetic? You know, is that an anachronistic or kind of culturally imperialist, you know, expecting them to have, when that just is not on the radar screen, it's like, no. You know, we defer to conventional ethics. And when we talk about the precepts, it has to do with ordination, just simply, you know, the precepts come from a lineage. It's been transmitted from the Buddha. And it's the lineage that's important rather than the content of the precepts. Or how do we, you know, live the precepts here in our monastic community? Let's share. You know, you don't get that kind of discourse. It's more... the precepts aren't even necessarily, we're going to talk about this tomorrow, it's not necessarily in historical Zen, the precepts aren't even necessarily used as a kind of set of ethical guidelines to figure out how to get along with each other. I mean, monastic codes will kind of handle that, but the precepts are often just the thing you received in your ordination to show that you're in a proper lineage, as opposed to, oh good, I have some moral tools to help me on my path. So the way that we might work with the precepts.
Yeah, I want to jump in here because we're actually a little over time, but having you here, I want to take a little more time, and there'll be tea and cookies and some time to talk personally with Chris. But rather than looking back at Imperial Way Japanese Zen, I know there's a lot of people in the room who have a lot to say, and I'd like to have other people, maybe some brief comments or questions. But I wanted to look at, you know, American exceptionalism and Imperial Way, you know, our Imperial Way and you know, the American support of the bombing of Gaza right now, or what's going on with climate change. How do we, in our context, use... You raised this in your talk, but I wonder if anybody has any comments or responses directly about our situation now and how to... use Buddhist, apply Buddhist contexts.
Sort of bring the Dharma to bear on...
Bringing it back, bringing it to what we're doing now. So I want to open that up, Daniel.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, are you trying to say that the 1930s Japanese Zen Buddhism is equivalent in authenticity to contemporary sort of 21st century Zen Buddhism?
In Japan or here in North America?
Like that practice of Buddhism is just as authentic as our practice of Buddhism. Is that what you're getting at? By saying things like it wasn't unexpected that they acted that way. That's what it is.
This is where I get into trouble with fellow scholars. No, there is a normative element, like toward the end of the book that we're talking about, where I in effect do show my cards and say, no, I think if you do look at certain core Buddhist values, again, at the risk of sort of essentializing Buddhism, you can make the argument that some of what was going on does seem to be antithetical against certain norms like non-harming, the vow to, you know, relieve the suffering of all sentient beings, self-effacement rather than self-aggrandizement. Even though all of those constructs I just mentioned lend themselves to multiple interpretations, but So yeah, I would say they're understandable. You can see how causes brought about that particular configuration of Buddhism, but I don't necessarily want to say that they're all, from my own perspective, equally authentic, moral, true to the deepest values of the tradition forms of Buddhism. Yeah, please.
Yeah. Just follow on to your question. I thought what you were saying was that you were wondering or you were questioning how plastic and how malleable is Zen Buddhism, because it produces, you know, f of x, I mean, based on 1930s, and it produces this answer, and the same f runs on, the same function is running on in the current time, and it produces a different answer that seem to have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
So exactly how is that process working?
Yeah, so that's where my attempt is to say, yeah, they can be interpreted in different ways. And is there anything in the tradition you can kind of lift up as a kind of touchstone, you know, a criterion on the basis of which to say, yeah, this I have problems with, this seems to be more in sync. And so that's, for me personally, I'll just put my cards on the table. I think, you know, it does have to do with the core Buddhist commitment to overcoming suffering. And, you know, again, we have the whole concept of suffering. How narrowly do we define that? Is it just purely a psychological existential state, like in traditional Buddhism, or do we expand suffering to include, violence, starvation, malnutrition, lack of medical care?
I guess I got lost in sight. You have two different, radically different situations. Mm-hmm. Using the same set of assumptions, you somehow write... you were calling on the list of words that you put out there for egalitarianism and nature and that, and versus things that we were looking at in Japan, both seem to be quite consistent. So what is it that allows Zen Buddhism to be that plastic, that it can be that malleable?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's a question for all. Maybe we'll just get a lot out here and then we can mull it over. Yeah,
Jim.
Just two random things, because your talk starts an awful lot of things.
Yeah, there's not a lot of closure tonight, sorry.
On the one hand, as far as malleability is concerned, looking at the other major religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, etc., this seems also the case. We've seen them in so many different historical contexts. But on the other hand, small point, you were describing, I think, some of the sort of social quietism, whatever, of Japanese Buddhism to the sort of foundation of Confucianism. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that might be especially Japanese Confucianism, because there is a radical critique of society in Chinese Confucianism. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, things blow sky high because the holders of power have fallen short of their duties.
And that's, yeah, the core doctrine you're getting at is the whole idea of the mandate of heaven, the idea that the emperor rules under the auspices of heaven as a kind of cosmic organizational power, and that if things are going awry, like famine and invasion by barbarians, that may seem that, or may indicate that the emperor has lost the mandate of heaven, therefore it's okay to rebel and depose him. The Japanese never accepted that doctrine of Confucianism.
Yes, right.
They have a totally different read on the mandate of heaven, and they basically said, no, that's a hapato. We're not going to, you know, incorporate that. The people do not have the right to topple the emperor when there's, you know, a plague or famine or whatever.
So when we have major storms and famines and droughts and so forth, we should get rid of the system of government we have? Is that...
Yes.
Tom and Ken had things. Tom.
Yeah. Okay. If I could just pivot for a second. Your talk was very good, and I appreciate the perspective a lot. But something that really struck out to me was you mentioned the three poisons: ignorance, ill will, and
greed.
Greed. I intern at UBS, and I sometimes feel that that is pervasive, not just in the industry, but sort of the corporate culture as well.
Yeah.
And so, and I try to practice in small ways what I think is compassion or what I think is non-harm. But that has increasingly become difficult. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that 2008 would have slowed that down. Mm-hmm. It did not. It sped it up. mm-hmm. Now, more than ever, it seems like in corporations and investment banking in particular, the presence of those three poisons has expanded such that even interns are taught those as virtues. Mm-hmm. Because those gain you clients, those gain you more money. Mm-hmm. So it's like you exist in a sort of hyper consumerist reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have ways that pragmatic ways that we could address that?
Yeah. What does Buddhism have to say about corporate banking?
Yeah. Yeah. So you have corporate greenwashing. This is like corporate dharma washing, or saying that we are more generous, loving and kind and wise, and I mean that you know, all I can say is that's the classic question of how to be an agent of change. To what extent can you be in those institutions, model different behavior, try to instill different values, and affect the corporate culture of that institution, or is that ultimately doomed to failure? If the basic raison d'etre as the corporation is return, maximum return to the shareholders. So to what extent, with that being a reality, can you really affect not only corporate culture, but the corporate agenda? So, maybe with publicly traded companies, it's a little trickier. Maybe with privately owned companies, maybe there's more ability to have a certain kind of, what we might call genuine social responsibility, as opposed to, PR, kind of greenwashing types of, self-presentation by the part of the institution. But that's the classic issue, yeah. I mean, do you try to transform it from within? What are the limitations in terms of, profit motive or other factors versus... Yeah, I guess it depends on the institution, but
Well, we're clearly not going to solve all this this evening, but I really appreciate the discussion. One last question, and then we'll close formally.
Something that comes to my mind is that Buddhism is relatively new in this country, and and if alleviation of suffering is a primary identifier for Buddhism, as perhaps it is for some other religions too, the Catholics could argue that's also a case for what they do, and even perhaps to a technique of faith and devotion and practices and everything. But for Catholics in America and overseas, and for Buddhists in China and in Japan, there's always been a social network that's been extensive, going out there for centuries, of local monasteries or local temples serving the population in very, with alms or with ceremonies and things like that. And I don't see that much of that activity in the Buddhist activity in America. And it might be one distinction that, we're just not, haven't progressed quite to that point yet. When you mentioned about a pragmatic form of having an impact, maybe we're approaching critical mass.
And the question is, what form of, let's just say web or network will it take? It may not be denominational, like the Catholic Church with its centralized, hierarchy and the bishops coming out with statements about this or that issue and, the parish priest sort of mobilizing the message. Maybe it will be something like the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. That becomes the sort of, the hub of the network. Or maybe, depending on how institutionalized Buddhism develops, maybe certain lineages, different Buddhist organizations sort of mobilizing people that way. And then it's, also the question of the nature of the practice. For a lot of us, why do we come to, say, this room? Okay, it may be to sit. It may not be to, you know, do local philanthropic activity. It may not be, I want to come here to help deal with the litter in the neighborhood or deal with, you know, the struggles of people who are unemployed in our community. And so, yeah, that's going to be interesting to see. You're right. It's so new, you know, sort of, you know, now maybe immigrant Buddhism is a little different, but at least in terms of, let's just call it convert Buddhism, yeah, institutionally, it's still so fluid. You know, I'm sure here in your sangha, you're still figuring out, okay, you know, just different roles and how do we do fundraising and who handles the, you know, the cooking and who's going to clean the kitchen. I mean, yeah, and so in one sense, I think a lot of North American Buddhists were freed up from historical baggage of institutions that may have been oppressive, like maybe some of the religious institutions we left, you know, to come to Buddhism. But the trade-off is, yeah, though we're sort of free and we have a lot of creative space, we don't have those traditional networks to fall back on and to mobilize, you know, around climate crisis or, you know, economic injustice or whatever. So, yeah.